This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who tucks Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Talamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Mike Penna and Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, jockey Christina McManigal, our producer Lee Delapina. We are with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, episode number 4 of Jock Talk. And Christina, I think you would agree, when we take a look at the guests we've had over the course of the first 3 weeks, and we're going to introduce our guests coming up here tonight in a moment, but these first 4 shows, I don't know how we could kick things off on a better note.
I don't know how we could. You're right. And every episode has been fantastic. And if you're not tuning in for every single one, you should. And we have someone else here today who will give us a really good show.
Yeah, absolutely. And just looking back on what we did the first 3 weeks, Mike Smith, the Hall of Famer, joined us in week 1. Chris McCarron was here in week number 2. And Johnny V last week telling his story, looking back on his career. And if you missed any of those, you can go back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and you can listen to the podcast of each and every Jock Talk show right there at horseracingradio.net. So you mentioned tonight's guest, and I'm very excited for tonight's guest because he's somebody that had a huge influence on my wife and I coming down to Kentucky. We've told that story multiple times on the show. He knows how much I think of him. He is jockey Shane Sellers, the 48-year-old native of Erath, Louisiana. He has won more than 4,300 races in a career that has just been outstanding. His mounts have earned more than $131 million in purses, and he is nice enough to be in studio with us here on Jock Talk tonight. Thanks, brother.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome to the I'm a little ticked off that you wore a nicer shirt than I did today.
Yeah, we always talk about our shirts. I just got this one.
I'm not happy. The nice gray shirt here, buttoned down. He's looking sharp.
Look at me. It's okay.
Look at me. You're beautiful.
No,
you're a rose,
I just
you're
came
a
from
rose
the
between two,
two
thorns.
Thorns.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, well, happy to have you with me, man, and really happy to have you here on the program. I know you're a huge supporter of PDJF and the Disabled Jockeys Fund, and, of course, a portion of the sponsorship from this show going back to benefit the PDJF and an organization that we can't do enough to support.
Yeah, and I appreciate it so much. Every opportunity that we have to put any money back into that organization is great. You know, we have some unfortunate riders that are put in some predicaments that are just out of their control, and for us to be able to give back to that organization is great, and we appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, amen. Absolutely happy to do whatever we can do. I mentioned growing up in Erath, and I mentioned the nearly 4,400 career victories, so take us back to the beginning, and first of all, tell me a little bit about Erath, because when I think of Erath, I think of names like Randy Romero, the Hall of Famer, who was from that town. I think of Kurt Bork, who is also a native of Erath, and even Randall Toops, yeah. who came
Tracy
out of
Hebert.
Erath. Tracy Hebert, yeah. Why is Erath such a hotbed?
I don't know. You know, it's not just Erath. I mean, from surrounding areas, right, like towns right next to it. Kent Zorman came from Maurice, Louisiana, which is 10 miles away. You know, all the other guys, you know, Mark Guidry, you know, you go on and name them, it's, you know, but they're within the 20, 25-mile area. But the little town of Erath, even my agent, Ronnie Ebanks, that you know, that's how we knew each other. We grew up in Erath, Louisiana. But we all started riding races at the Bush Tracks in Abbeville, Louisiana, which is about 6 miles away. And I grew up with some friends of mine who had race horses, and I would do anything to get on to be around horses, and they happened to have horses, and they were race horses. They had other horses that we would ride, but they happened to have race horses, and I would go to the match tracks with them. And I told my dad one day, I said, you know, I want to be a jockey. He said, and he was a tough old guy, and he said, you want to be a jockey, boy? I said, yes, sir. That's what I want to do. He said, well, I'm going to find, and he found this older guy, Mr. B.B. Abear, and he said, he went and talked to him, and he said, well, I'll take him in for the summer. And I was like 10 and a half years old, and I'll take him in for the summer, and he'll stay with me, and I'll teach him to ride. And my dad said, you want to do it? I said, yes, sir. And so I went, and I slept with his son in the bed, and they only had like 3 bedrooms, but and the other one was occupied. So I slept with him. I'd get up at 4:30 in the morning and clip muck stalls, and he'd get on the pony and put me on, you know, thoroughbreds, which at the time was, they were monsters. I mean, they would run at the recognized racetracks, and he'd teach me. He'd just, you know, teach me how to hold on, teach me how to put my feet. And
what was that like the first time you ever sat on a horse?
Oh my God, I can still remember that. I mean, especially I had rode horses, you know, Shetland ponies and stuff, but these were race horses that were, you know, tough to gallop. They were, you know, they were racy. They was wanting to race, you know, and he'd hold that pony, you know, and he wasn't afraid to put me on him, and I wasn't afraid to get on him. I didn't know what I was doing, but it was a rush like I never had before in my life, and I knew from that moment that's what I wanted to do, even though I didn't know what I was doing, you know. So I'd get up at 4:30 in the morning, we'd eat a little breakfast and go muck stalls, and then whatever else we had to do, get in the fields and, you know, work other things other than riding the racehorses. But I stuck with it and stayed the whole summer. So, and you know, and then on Sundays, he lived right next door to the match tracks, which we all learned how to ride, which is Claymont's racetrack that Randy, all of us rode at. So he lived right, in fact, his brother owned it.
Yeah.
So I would go to the racetrack on Sundays with my friends, and everybody watched the match track, you know, like the match races like we had always done. And after the summer, I wanted to, and he told me, no, you're not ready to ride. And he had an old pony, and he was about 22 years old. And towards the end of the summer, he said, okay, we're going to learn how to get pop out of the gate. And I said, okay. And
how old are you at this point?
I was 10.
Okay.
I was less than 11. I was 10 and a half years old. I weighed about 60 pounds, and I was so excited. I'd been
That's a lot of animal underneath you for a 60-pound person. Yeah.
Even though a pony, he was 22, but he could leave the gate, you know, because he was an old horse that he used to run in the match tracks. Boy, and I was excited. I was ready to go, and I was, you know, he said, now you got to be ready. It was like 2 months I'd been there towards the end of the summer, and he put me on him, and boom, we left the gates, done it 2 or 3 times, and I thought, I'm ready to go. He said, No, you got to come back one more summer, and then we're going to go. Well, I went back home and kept going to the match tracks, and then my friends, his dad wanted me to ride a match race, and that old man was mad. He said, if you do that, and I went ahead and I rode.
Of course, I went ahead and I rode.
Yeah, and he was there at the race, and I won my first race, and he was proud of me, man, but, you know, he said, you did it. And, you know, I was looking for his approval. He said, you did it. You did it. And then I never stopped after that. So that's how I got started.
So you won your first race ever. That's pretty impressive. Tell us about the bush tracks. How was that like to ride?
Oh, it was the most fun that I've ever had. You know, my friend Laurie Black posted something on Facebook the other day, and they had a picture. She had showed a picture of the gates at Karen Crow Raceways, and which we all rode at. We rode there, and we rode in Maurice. We went around, you know. And Karen Crow closed a couple of years after we started, but it was the most popular one. They had just a racetrack straight away, and then they had two lanes. They had a two rails and then a rail in the middle.
Oh, wow.
So you run in the rails. And she had a picture of one in the gate with, you know, somebody took a picture in 77, I think it was. And they had a guy starting holding the horse, and a guy in the gate with a little bitty guy. The horse was trying to flip on him, and then they had one from the gates, and the horse leaving the gate in the rails. Two horses leaving the gates, and it brought back so many memories, you know. And you asked me about that, and it was the most fun I've ever had in racing ever. You know, it was just fun. I mean, they had so many people that would come out to watch the races. You know, I never saw a horse break down, never, you know, saw horses go through. You know, it was just, you saw some accidents happen, but it was just so much fun. It was just a lot of fun. You know, I was 11 when I started. When you're 11 years old and you have your dreams, and you have this happen, and you know, me and Calvin Borrell started together. We rode at the same match tracks together.
Wow.
I have hundreds of pictures of me and him riding against each other.
Did you know he was going to be good when you were riding?
Oh, absolutely.
With him? Yeah,
absolutely. We both wanted it. You know, on Friday nights they would have a supper. We, you know, it was supper, and all the guys, we'd cook a supper at Claremont's racetrack. All the guys would go and they'd start drinking, and you know, they'd match their horse, had a big chalkboard, and by the end of the night, you can't beat me up, Bob, you know. And here we'd go, me and Cal, we'd go to the chalkboard. Well, I'm riding that. And I remember we'd play pool, and we had to pick this pool sticks over our head to play pool, you know, and we was all excited. Well, Sunday we riding this one, Sunday we riding that one. So it was a lot of fun, and you know, we didn't know it was going to be good, but we knew that's what we wanted, and that's what we were going to do. And we never dreamed of riding the races that we rode. We just wanted to get to the next step. We wanted to get to Evangeline Downs. You know, that was the next big step.
Sure.
You know, and at the time we made it to Evangeline Downs, we was happy to be there. We didn't think we was going to leave there. You know, we rode there, and dreams make you, you know, when you're trying to fulfill a dream, opportunities take you to the next level. And you know, we made it to where we are today.
Every time I have talked with somebody like Calvin or Eddie Delahousse or Kent, anybody that kind of came up that same way you did in riding at the Busch Tracks, they all credit those races for their success, because they've told me it makes you tough. Mm-hmm. And you have to fight your way through that level in order, as you said, to get to the likes of Evangeline Downs.
It they're absolutely correct. And not only that, you know, I know, you know, like Chris McCarron has a school where, you know, people start at 18, 19, 20, and, you know, they start older in life. We were riding at 11 years old, you know, and it teaches you how to, you know, hold across, hold your whip, put your feet down, leave the gates, get a feel of the horse, know how to hold on, put your seat. You know, we learned our seat very early in life, and then you go from there and keep riding, and it, you develop, your seat gets better, and so on and so forth. But it was a great start for all of us, and we had a start, you know, in front of everybody else.
That's amazing that you're 11 years old, and you're riding, and I guess it just becomes second nature to you.
Yeah, and you were only, what, 16 when you won your first race at Evangeline?
Yeah, I was 16. Yeah, so
that had
been
riding
for you. It was. I'll never forget it. It was an incredible moment. It was incredible.
Did you feel like you were on your way at that point?
Again, you know, when you started that young and you started from the country tracks that we started from, we were all from poor families. You know, I was on my way, but not thinking I was on my way to where I am today.
What was your first big break?
When I left Fairmont Park, I left Delta Downs, and I was riding Evangeline Downs and Delta. And somebody kept telling, you know, you need to get out of here. You need to get out of here. You need to get out of here. And I had no connections. And I went to Oaklawn Park, and I rode there. And I wasn't doing any guy. You know, I win one race at the meet and have an agent. And the guy told me to go to Fairmont Park. He said, you go to Fairmont Park and, you know, you'll win some races. And I went there, and I was leading rider there in 86. No, I wasn't leading rider. I went there in 86. I was third leading rider, and I was leading rider in 87. And I went ride a horse called Soakin' Smokin'. He was Illinois bred from Fairmont Park at Hawthorne, and he won. And Ronnie Ebanks was kind of towards the end of his career riding, and he was running the kitchen, and he came up hugging me. Man, I hadn't seen you in so long. Man, I'm so glad you're doing good. He said, you think you want to come up and ride at Hawthorne in Chicago? He said, man, I'm looking for a rider, and you know, we'll get some ride for some horses for Wayne Catalano, and you know, and so on. I said, I'd love to. And I went to Chicago with Ebanks, and Wayne Catalano put me on everything he had. He was training for John Franks, and the rest is history.
Talking with Shane Sellers on Jock Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
So Shane, if you had not become a jockey, what would you have done?
I have no earthly idea. I really don't. I never thought of doing anything else. I was good in school. My dad made me graduate, you know, and I was, you know, I made A's and B's in school because I had to. And the last year of my high school year, I moved to Vinton, Louisiana, which is Delta Downs, and I bought a camper trailer and shared it with a trainer friend of mine so I could finish school. And I did. I finished school. But I had nothing in my mind other than riding racehorses since I was 11 years old. So there was nothing in my mind other than riding racehorses. I really don't know what I was going to do.
The last time you rode in a race, June 15th, 2013 at Indiana Grand. Miss it?
Yes. I miss it sometimes. You know, when I watch the big races and I still see some of my friends that I rode with still riding, you know, I question, can I do it? But, you know, my knees were bad. And, you know, I was, when I had when I got away from racing in 2005, I lost a lot of business. And then when I came back, I didn't have those opportunities that I had before. And, not having the opportunities to ride the big races and, you know, riding two or three a day, which was not the quality of horses that I was riding before, my knees was hurting and fighting my weight. It all, you know, I said, you know, I need to do something else.
Did you know when you walked off the track that night in Indiana that it might be for the last time?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because I had came back and, you know, when you come back off of not riding for a while, and you gave it everything you had, and the opportunity is just not coming, and you're getting older in life. I was 47, 46 years old. You know, where are you going to go?
Come on, it's a spring chicken.
Yeah. according to today, these guys, you know, it is, you know. But, yeah, I knew I needed to do something else. And, you know, I didn't want to stand the pain no more. You know, I didn't want to fight my weight and be riding where I was riding. And, but I do miss it very much, especially it's hard for me to watch the big races, you know, and I still see, you know, my best friend, Mike, you know, Smith still. And then I watch Gary Steven go through a knee replacement and come back and ride and still winning and stuff like that. But,
does that make you think about it?
Oh, sure it does. Sure it does.
If they can do it.
Yeah, sure does. And when I came back, you know, I still thought I had to, you know, you don't lose your ability to ride. It's in your mind. It's what you know in between your head, you know, in your head is, you know, you don't lose that ability to ride, you know, but you lose, if you don't have the horses, you can't use that ability, you know, and that's what I tell a lot of these young kids, you know, it's not you per se, it's 90% horse, you know, if you don't have the horse, you're not going to win, but if you do have the horse and you can cross your reins a little bit, you're going to get them home,
yeah.
You know, and that's what a lot of people don't understand. I wouldn't have won 4,300 races if I didn't have horse. You know, Mike Smith wouldn't be Mike Smith if he didn't have opportunities. Jerry Bailey. You go on and on, that Pat Day. You know, there was a time when we didn't win that many races. We didn't win at the clip that we won. It's because we wasn't riding the horses that we had got an opportunity at some point in time in our career to ride, you know. So, you know, I never thought I was better than the next guy. Any guy that was, you know, the decent rider could have become a better rider with better horses,
yeah.
And you do. You become, you know, I became a better rider when I, you know, when I left Fairmont Park and I went to ride at Sportsman's Park in Hawthorne, I started riding for Wayne Catalano. My riding changed because I was riding better horses.
Sure.
You know, and I was like, oh my God, these horses are so faster. They was much faster, more stamina. I could put them in, if I saw a hole and I could go and I'd chirp at them, they would jump in that hole. I could wait a lot longer, and and I was like, oh man, this is good, you know. And then all of a sudden, I took off but I was riding for everybody in the country, you know. So everything's all about horses. Everything's about horses.
You have to have something to work with, right?
Yeah.
But tell us about your when you made the move to Kentucky.
When I made the move to Kentucky, I'd started with Ronnie at Sportsman and Hawthorne, and we would go back and forth, but we had to go to Arlington in the summers, and man, that was incredible. I went the year after it burnt down. I rode a little bit in the when it before it burnt, when we was running the tents, and met Pat Day in early fires, and it was like, oh my God. And anyway, things started.
Were you kind of awestruck when you met those guys?
Of course I was. Of course. Wow. I was. I mean, it was incredible to be riding with these guys.
Kind of like the first time I met Shane Sellers.
Yeah, but I just was a student of the game, and I just watched them, you know. And I wasn't riding the kind of horses they were, so I wasn't winning as much as they were. But I still had Wayne Catalano pushing me, and I ended up fifth or sixth leading rider. Mike was like seventh. Mike Smith was there. He was like seventh in the standings, you know. And then he went from there to New York. But anyway, I stayed around the Chicago circuit till 92. But in 91, I broke Randy Romero's record, which still stands today. I won 217 races in the meet. I was winning four or five a day, riding for Carl Nasker, all of Wayne's, Michelle Boyle. I was riding for everybody. And I just couldn't do no wrong, because everything I rode was 2-1, 3-1, you know, no less than 5-1. Everything was just running out of the TV screen. And Ronnie said, we need to go to Keeneland. Because I'd shipped in and wrote, win the grade one for Bert Saunier. And Ronnie said, we need to go to Keeneland. And we went to Keeneland. And the purses were much bigger in Kentucky than they were there. And Ronnie said, we need to make that move. And I think it was in 93. I came to Kentucky, and we never left.
And got into a pretty good rivalry with Hall of Famer Pat Day as well. You mentioned his name earlier.
Yeah.
That was quite a contest between you and Pat for a while there at Keeneland and Churchill Downs.
It was. I remember the first year I beat him for leading rider, and we loved each other. I mean, I loved Pat, but I think he was leading rider for, I don't know, 18 or 20 years there, you know, here for a long, long time. And when I was leading rider, he was happy for me, but like anything, you know, it looked like maybe I was the new kid on the block.
Yeah.
And I was young, and I don't think I was cocky. I was confident.
No, not Shane Sellers.
I might have been a little cocky. I don't know.
A little outspoken here and there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But I stood my ground, you know, and by that time I'd been riding good horses, and I was riding for a lot of people. So, you know, I thought at that point, I am as good as you. You know, I am as good as the next guy.
Yeah.
You know, at that point.
Well, you have to have that belief.
And I did.
Any great athlete does.
You know, I did, and you know, I was riding good horses. I was riding as good horses or better horses than he was, you know. So it was a great move, and for my career, and the rest, like I said, is history.
Well, you were as good as them. But so you've won riding titles at Keeneland, Churchill, Gulfstream, Hawthorne, Sportsman's Park, Fairmont Park, and Delta Downs.
Wow.
That's pretty impressive. That's pretty.
Yeah, I thought about that the other day. I was thinking about that. Yeah. I was very fortunate. I was very fortunate every racetrack that I went to and every step that I made. And you know, I'm grateful that I didn't stay at those places. I took the next step until I couldn't take another step, you know, forward. And I was able to ride in Hong Kong and Japan and Dubai, and went around the world and rode, and, you know, it was very fun.
In December of 2000, you have the knee injury, which basically sidelines you for, what, 4.5 years or so before you decide to try to make that comeback.
Yeah.
How tough was that on you?
It was hard. It was very hard. It was like my world came to an end, the world that I knew.
Because you had it rolling.
I was rolling.
It was the prime.
Yeah, yeah. And I had left that year. I was leading rider at Gulfstream Park, and in 1 year I was leading rider the whole meet, and Jerry Bailey won 5 races the last day to beat me. Mm. He beat me by one. He won the last race of the meet. We were tied. And he won the last race of the meet to beat me for a leading rider. So in the next year, Frankie Brothers, I was riding everything for Frankie and Claiborne.
Were you in that last race with Jerry that day?
And I'll tell that story.
Riding the hair off the horse.
I had won two that day, I was, and he won four to tie me. And there was one race, and he came and gave me a hug. We were close. Our little kids was close. You know, we'd go out to dinner and eat, and he came hug me. He said, you know what? I really don't care if I win this race. If we could tie, it'd be great. He said, because, you know, we both had a great meet, and I think he was on a horse 6-1.
Did you believe him?
Oh, yeah.
Every jockey wants to win that title.
And Jerry was very competitive. He was like me. He was borderline cocky, you know, borderline confident cocky, you know. And but I believed he meant it. You know, he really, he was going to win. But in his heart, you know, he was like, if I don't win this, it would be great, you know. I was in front every step of the way, you know. And I remember he was on a horse with Mr. Polson. And he had them striped red, white, and blue. Colors. It was on the grass. It was a 12 horse field, and I was sixth or seventh. He was fourth. My horse on the backside. I could feel my horse. I was giving out, and I was chirping at him. Come on, man, get in the game. At some point in the race, you know you're out of horse. I knew at the half mile pool I was out of horse, and I kept him in my sights. He was. He dropped back to sixth. He was going in the turn. He was bottled up. He had nowhere to go. Nowhere to go. And I can't say I was pulling against him, but I was like, just please don't win this race. I mean, my emotions were so up and down that day.
Right.
And the day before, because I knew he had a lot of live horses. And I kept getting higher in the saddle and higher in the saddle in the middle of the turn. And I just remember when I turned for home, I was almost standing up watching, and he put a magnificent ride. He went inside, he came outside, went inside of two horses, and he went by head and put an unbelievable ride and beat me in the last day for leading rider. So, yeah, I did watch it. I saw that I had the best seat in the house.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, Shane, I guess what I maybe know you best from is years ago I watched the HBO documentary Jockey, and it's just, I mean, it shows how it really is, and it shows you yourself with Randy Romero during his difficulties. And tell us about that a little bit.
Well, you know, I've always been, again, an outspoken guy. I wasn't ever afraid to put my career or anything in front of my career or to hurt my career if I believed in it for riders. When I started to do good in Chicago, they asked me to be a representative of the guild, and I said yes, I was going to do it. And being a representative of the guild, you have to be a stand-up guy, you know, and I stood. And when it came for Randy's deal, I saw a man that was dying because of the things that he put his life and the things that I knew I was doing and the people that I knew, you know, 80% of the riders that I knew were doing. And I knew that something needed to be done, and they asked me to do it. And would I do it? And I said, I thought about it, and I said, you know, I'll do it, because I wasn't riding at the time. I was thinking about coming back, and I said, yeah, I'll do it. And we did the deal, and it was all about changing the weights, and it did change the weights. You know, we brought the weights up for, you know, 3 or 4 pounds, and I can't say I regret it, you know. I mean, it was something I had a lot. I burned a lot of bridges with it. You know, there were a lot of people that were for it, but it burned a lot of bridges for me in the game, because a lot of guys wouldn't stand up. You know, they wouldn't come out and say, yes, 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 we do it. You know, we do these things, and that we need these changes. So it hurt me in a lot of ways. You know. Emotionally, it hurt me that these guys didn't stand up for me when I knew that they were doing the same things that I was doing. I knew that, you know, they needed the weights to change. You know, I knew that they wanted the weights to change, and it was an avenue for us to get it changed. But I watch it sometimes. You know, I go back because I'm at the end of my, you know, my career's over. And I look back on the good things, and I look at some of those things that I did. And, you know, and there's a big part of me that's proud of what I did, you know, because it did change racing. And people did come around, you know, after it did change the way, you know, the weights and everything. It brought the weights up. They knew it didn't hurt racing. So I managed to mend some of those bridges. But it was a pivotal part in my career, and it was a part that probably hurt me a little bit when I was trying to get back to racing, because I did come back after that, and it did hurt me a little bit. There were some guys that wouldn't give me a chance again after that.
We're going to step away for a short break. We'll come back and continue our visit with Shane Sellers here on Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. When we come back, we will look at that day that you made your comeback at Evangeline Downs. It was a remarkable day for you, very emotional. We'll talk about that in a moment. We'll also look back on some of the career highlights of Shane Sellers, including a little horse by the name of Pulpit. We'll do that next on Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word JOCKEY to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word JOCKEY to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
Find out why HRRN is good for your wallet on the ExpressBet Weekend Stakes Preview.
This is very lucrative.
Our expert handicappers will break down the weekend's biggest races in detail and give you their ExpressBet of the day.
Big money! Big money.
The ExpressBet Weekend Stakes Preview. Fridays, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern on Sirius 220 and XM 206. Or streaming live at horseracingradio.net. Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.
And we're going to kick things off with trainer Graham Motion, Hall of Fame trainer Phil Mott here on Trainer Talk. Roger Atfield is going to be with us for the next half an hour. Carl Nasker, an honor to have him on the show tonight. Hall of Fame trainer Shug McGahey, nice enough to spend some time with us. I want to welcome Hall of Famer Bob Baffert to the program.
Trainer Talk, the biggest names in horse racing. Wednesdays, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern on Sirius 220 and XM 206. And always streaming live at horseracingradio.net. Thursday evenings, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern, is the Brisnet.com call-in show. It's your chance to call in and let the Horse Racing Radio Nation know what's on your mind. Call us at 888-966-HRRN and discuss the topics you choose in the world of thoroughbred racing. The Brisnet.com call-in show, every Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern, on Sirius 220 and XM 206, or streaming live online at horseracingradio.net. If it happens in horse racing, it happens on HRRN.
But California Chrome shines bright in the Kentucky Derby!
What a memorable Breeders' Cup Classic! It's a race for the ages!
Here's the wire, and it's a photo finish that goes to Tonelin!
Wise Dan gets his head in front! The first $1 million race in Keeneland history!
Racing's biggest events are right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
My name is Abel Escanos. Listen to Horse Racing Radio Network.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
The field turns for home with a championship on the line here. And Countess Diana is up to the test, and she sparks away, shrugging off the challenge of Career Collection. And farther back, finally coming up the inside of a dazzling effort here by Countess Diana. She rambles home to an impressive eighth-length victory here over Career Collection, finally finishing third. Wow, what a spectacular effort there. And there is Patrick Byrne. Boy, didn't he make look it easy in his first career starter in the Breeders' Cup. And Countess Diana, no doubt about it, you are looking at a champion.
Countess Diana winning the 1997 Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies. That was the first of two Breeders' Cup wins for jockey Shane Sellers. And we welcome you back to Jock Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, jockey Christina McManigal, and our producer Lee Delapina visiting with Shane Sellers here. And it's been an enjoyable first half of the program. Really looking forward to the second half. And Shane, we look back on that effort by Countess Diana, and it's funny, before the program I says, hey Shane, what do you want to hear coming out of the commercial break? You want to hear Buck's Boy? You want to hear Countess Diana? And you said to me, has to be Countess Diana. She was my first.
Yeah, she was my first, and she was a good one. She was a good one. She could really run, and it was a very emotional time that you know, and one of the easiest races I ever had to ride that day.
Really?
Yeah, she was a front runner. She was speed horse, and she was much the best of those horses, you know, throughout her career of that year, and on a speed bias racetrack in California. So I got her, you know, right off the lead, a half length off the lead up the backside. I couldn't really hold her, you know, nobody contested her. I turned it for home. I just let her out, and she went by 7 or 8 lengths. And you know, to be my first to win that easy, to be your first British Cup win, it was exciting.
Yeah, the first of a couple. Of course, Buck's Boy, the next year, a huge win with the Illinois bred, which had to be pretty cool.
How about that? He had everything going against him. He was an Illinois bred. He was 15-something, you know, hands tall, and a front runner, and gelding, and going a mile and a half on the turf. You know,
that's supposed to happen.
It's not supposed to happen. But little bitty horse, but he could run. He had everything that it took, and stamina. And again, he was one of those horses. If he got to the front, he would pace himself. Easy horse to ride. Very easy horse to ride. It was fun.
We're going to spend some time in the second half of the show looking back on some of those memorable moments and some of the bigger races that you've been part of. There have been so many. But I want to backtrack just a little bit. We left off in the first half talking about what you went through after that knee injury and having to make your way back. Well, you did come back in 2003 and 2004, and you got right back to riding at a very high level, winning the Traverse Stakes with Unshaded. You won the Bluegrass Stakes with the Cliff's Edge and came back and rode them in the Kentucky Derby that same year. How were you able to get back so quickly?
Well, when I started to come back, I took Fred Amy as my agent. He called me one day and he said, Steve Asmussen wants you to ride First Call for him. I said, what?
Okay.
Are you kidding me? And, you know, I said, duh, yes. And I couldn't believe it, you know, because he was leading training in the country. And that's how it got me rolling again. Steve got me rolling again. He had some great two-year-olds, which I love riding two-year-olds. And he got me rolling again, and people saw me winning again. And when they see you winning, they'll give you an opportunity. But it was because of Steve Asmussen.
Tell us about Shane. So you've had several comebacks, and the most recent you have bad knees. I have bad hips, so, you know, we make a good group here. But tell us about some of your previous injuries.
You know, I was very fortunate. I never had a whole lot of injuries. I broke my arm when I was riding Skip Away, not on him, but when I was, you know, in the course of riding him, and I lost the mount on him for a couple races and was fortunate enough to get back on him. But I never had, other than that, and in my knee, which was the worst one, I never had many injuries that kept me sidelined for, you know, other than that, I never had any injuries that kept me set on the sidelines.
The Shane Sellers story that I found maybe most interesting as I was looking back through some of your moments getting ready for the show was, let's call it your second comeback in 2009. Mm-hmm. Of course, after you left the saddle in 2004, you took about a 4.5-year break. You had that public incident at Churchill Downs, which really got picked up by the national media, and that got spun out of control. So you get discouraged for those 4.5 years, take some time away from the game. Where were you mentally at that point before you came back in 2009?
I was confused, because those 4 years after what happened at Churchill Downs, I lost my passion for the game. I didn't feel like I was in the brotherhood with my riders because of what they did to me or what they allowed to happen to me at Churchill. And I just moved from Kentucky. I left Kentucky and I went back home to Louisiana. And I thought, you know, at that time it's over. I didn't want to ride anymore. I didn't want to be a part of it. I didn't feel like I was a part of it. I had fought the weights, you know, and then now it made it look like it was my fault because of the insurance, which I was wanting to change, but it made it look like I did it, which I didn't. And then the insurance was changed, but it looked like I was just fighting all of these fights, and I was a part of them, but I was tired of fighting. I was tired of being in there. I didn't feel like I was part of the brotherhood, and I got away. But so mentally, I was in a bad state. You know, I went to rehab. I was drinking a lot. I went to rehab, and I think it was almost 4 years. And I looked at my little boy, and he was playing lacrosse, and he was very good. And I said, "You know what, Bubby? What do you think if Daddy goes back to riding?" And he looked at me, and he said, "Dad, you can do it." And he said, "I was waiting for you to tell me that." And from that, day on, I didn't know where I was going to start back, because I was, you know, in Louisiana. I said, "You know what? You know, swallow your pride and just go somewhere and start galloping." I weighed 150 pounds. And just start going galloping. And I found one of these old guys that used to be on the bush tracks. And he had some old country horses in a little town. And I said, "You know what?" Because I didn't want to really go to the track. I didn't know if I still had. I mean, I didn't want nobody to see me getting on a horse 150 pounds. And, you know, here's Shane Sellers, you know. So I went and I started galloping horses, and I was out of shape. And I went and breezed a couple of horses at the old match track where I started riding. And again, I put my pride aside, and there was many days I said, "Man, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing?" But I had to convince myself that I wanted to really do this. I didn't want to go to the track and then say, you know what, I don't want to do it. Or I lost my confidence. You know, or maybe you can't do it. And I didn't want to be embarrassed, you know, because I was once, you know, Shane Sellers. You know, I won all these big races and a lot of races, and people always said, "You know, you're a great rider," and then go and not be that rider again. So anyway, I started breezing horses again until I got my weight down, and until I got about 130 pounds. And then I said, "Well, I'm going to go to Evangeline now, and so I'm going to take another step, just like when I started in the first place." And I took that next step, and I went to Evangeline now, and I started getting on horses. And I hadn't talked to Mark since that whole deal happened at Churchill. I didn't talk to no riders, you know. They didn't call me. I didn't call them. I really didn't want anything to do with any of them guys. I was really mad. You know, it really hurt me bad. And I saw Mark one day. He's my little boy's godfather. He's one of my best friends ever in my life.
Yeah.
And he came and hugged me and put me on a couple of horses to breeze. "I'm going to give you a couple of horses to breeze." And I started working horses, and people started seeing me. And it was a part of me that was a little embarrassed, you know, that I was having to start back at the smaller tracks, you know. And again, your pride, you know, it's Shane Sellers, man. He's riding an event. What is he doing here, you know? So Mark put me on a couple horses, and I wasn't fit. And one day he said, "I'm entering a horse for you to ride." And I said, "Mark, I'm not fit." He said, "Little brother, you ain't got to be fit to ride this. And I'm going to run him for $25,000. I'm going to drop him to $25,000. He'll run out the TV screen. You don't have to be fit." I said, "Mark, my weight's not right. I mean, I weigh 122 pounds. He said, "He's in with 23. Don't worry. If you're a pound or two over, I don't care. I'm going to tell the owner. Don't worry about it. If you do 24, 25, I don't care." So I was like, "Mark, man, I don't know. I'm not fit." And he said, "Well, you want to ride him or you don't want to ride him?" I said, "All right, I'll ride him." And I remember I attacked 24 that night. He was in with 22. And I called him. I said, "I'm 20. He said, "I told you it don't matter." And sure enough, he laid third with me. I chirped at him around the turn. He opened up and went by three. And it was just an emotional moment for me and him. We both cried. And my kids were there, and they were happy. And I went from there. You know, I went on. I started riding a few horses, got my weight down. You know, people understood I was going to be heavy. And they let me get my weight down and started riding a few horses. And Asmussen had some horses at Evangeline. And then sure enough, he gave me a call and he said, you want to start riding some horses again for me? I said, yeah. And I went to there and then went onto the fairgrounds and started riding for Steve again. And that's how we started back.
Visiting with Shane Sellers here on Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And boy, you think back on that story and how your career really did just come full circle before you ended up stepping away here just a couple of years ago. Let's talk about some of the true highlights in your career. And we'll start, I think, with the horse that really captured a lot of people's hearts, and that's Pulpit, who arrived at the Kentucky Derby. When I did my research, I thought he was the favorite for the Kentucky Derby in 97. He actually, I believe, was third choice. Captain Bodgett was the favorite that year. And he comes to the Derby in 97, a horse that you just absolutely fell in love with.
Yeah, and I always say, people say, who's the best horse you ever rode? And I'll say, Pulpit. And they say, what? Because I rode Skip Away, you know, and Skip Away run up 10 million and won the Classic. And they say, what? I said, well, on paper, Skip Away is the best horse I ever rode. But flesh, you know, ability-wise, Pulpit was the best horse I ever rode. And I always said, I wish people could have seen what I felt in the mornings. He was a great horse. He was a great horse. Unfortunately, he was only able to make six races. But from the very first time I sat on him, because Frankie hid him from me some kind of way. Because, you know, I worked horses at the barn, and I never worked Pulpit. And one day he was in at Gulfstream Park, and I was leading rider, and I got in the paddock, and this big, good-looking horse came out. Seth Hancock and Dale Hancock, all the Hancock family was there, the mom. I'm like, what's going on here? You know, I knew all the horses, but, you know, that I was working. And he legged me up, and he said, you know, like always, good luck, you know. Never gave me no instructions, never, you know. So I was on 8 horses that day, and I was riding good horses. So I didn't think nothing of it, you know. And he left the gate. He opened up 4 or 5 on these horses, and he threw his ears forward, and I just put a long cross on. He went in the turn, and he was in, his ears was pricking far, and I could hear him, pap, pap. They were hitting in behind me. It was chirping, hitting behind me. I'm like, I could hear it faintly. I could hear it. He's opening up, you know.
Best sound in racing?
Oh, my God. I'm like, what am I sitting on here, you know? And he turned for home and switched leads, and I chirped at him, and he hit a gear, like, and I let him out till the 8th pole, and I just eased him up from the 8th pole to the wire, and he went 22 flat, I think it was. He was right off the track record, and was just the easiest race. I got off, and my eyes was this big, and we took a picture, and I was walking with Seth Hancock, and I said, man, Seth, he can run. He said, well, and that's what he'd always say we'll see. He said, we'll see. But he said, you know what, in all my years, I've never seen one break is made that easy. He said, we might have a good one here. And from that moment on, every time I rode him, he was just incredible. Yeah. You know.
Tell us about, you mentioned Skip Away, so tell us about Skip Away, who was second in the 96 Preakness, but I guess the most memorable race was the Jockey Club Gold Cup in 96. Tell us about that.
Well, I'll just try to, how I got the mount. I was at Gulfstream, and Jerry had rode him, I think it was the Cowden at Aqueduct, and he bled that day. And me and Jerry, you know, at that moment, I really didn't have a big horse yet, but, you know, I was winning a lot of races at Gulfstream, and every year we was just looking for 3-year-olds, and we'd have to wait until Jerry or, you know, Jerry would always have, Pat Day would always have 3 or 4 mounts, and we'd have to wait until somebody. And so this horse came open, a Skip Away. And Ronnie was like, you know, we don't have, Sonny Hind wants you to ride him. He bled last time, and he didn't have blinkers, and he was going to put blinkers on him. Can you go work him? I said, sure. So I worked him. He worked 3/4 of a mile, and he worked in 12 and change. And I looked at Ronnie and said, oh, my God. I mean, this horse can run. So he ran him in a allowance race, and I rode him. He went by about 8 or 9 lengths. Then I rode him in the Florida Derby. And he was 3rd. And I said, Ronnie, here's our Derby horse. And Ronnie, he threw his hands up. Oh, you, come on. He said, you know, this can, I said, Ronnie, don't look for another one. I'm, you know, because we still had the Bluegrass to go. we still had some time to for other guys to shuffle around. And he said, don't. I said, I'm telling you, don't look for another horse. This is my Derby horse right here. And he kind of got a little agitated with me, you know. And so we ran him in the bluegrass, and he ran out the TV screen. And then now Ronnie was like, you know, I think I'm almost positive he was favored for the Derby. He was one of the top two favorites for the Derby. And he had that high action, and he really didn't handle the Churchill Down surface. And then we went on, he was second in the Preakness, and he was still a three-year-old, and I think it was after the, yeah, I got hurt, and I lost him, and Santos rode him in the Belmont. He was second, and went and rode him in New Jersey, and was beat. And Sonny was a little agitated the way he run. He said, would you ride him back? I said, yeah. So he said, we're going to run him with older horses at Belmont. We're going to run him against Cigar. And I said, oh, boy. Oh, boy.
You're not setting your bar too high, are you?
Yeah, right. But he, you know, I had worked him again, and I told Ronnie, I said, they would come and interview, and I said, I don't know if I can beat him, but if there's a horse that can beat him today, I'm on this horse. I know he's a three-year-old, but he was a big horse. He was a big strapping horse. He had a long stride on him. And sure enough, I got a good break and laid second behind a horse for Zito. I could feel him stopping. I could see him. He was getting out with Pat, and Pat was, he started to stop on Pat, and I just kept slowing him down without taking a lead. And I said, well, as long as nobody presses me, I'm not going to move on him. And I was able to set to the quarter pole. And I said, if I could set to the quarter pole, I'm going to open him up, and I'm going to let him out. And if Cigar catches me, he catches me. And I couldn't believe that nobody came to me until the quarter pole. And I set him down, and I asked him for everything. He exploded. And inside the 16th pole, I could feel Cigar coming at him. And then when he got next to me, he found just a little bit more, and he went by ahead. And it was the most incredible feeling. I almost fell off when I was trying. I was waving my stick in the air. If you watch the head on, I was waving my stick in the air, and I hit my butt on the saddle. You know, it was like, and he beat Cigar. He beat Cigar. It was the biggest, one of the biggest races of his or my career.
Outside of Pulpit and Skip Away, which are obviously maybe the two more notable horses you've been part of, what other horses, when you think back on your career, are going to be horses that you're never going to forget?
I rode a good filly, Heritage of Gold. She was an older filly for Tom Amos. You know, Connors Diana, Bucks Boy. You know, to go back on them, I'd have to look back on.
Yeah, there are so many good ones.
You know, I wrote some good ones.
I'm looking back through the list now. Mighty, Captain Steve, Arabian Light. Yeah. I mean, let's just keep, you know, there's Heritage of Gold, right?
Yeah, I wrote Heritage of Gold. She was probably the best one. She was a mare, and she was an older mare, and I won races on the dirt with her. I won races on the grass with her. I won four grade ones on her. She was a good one. She was a good one that a lot of people don't talk about. She was third in the Breeders' Cup Distaff. I rode some good ones. I was very fortunate in my life to ride some good ones.
So, Shane, tell us also about, other than riding, you've done a few things such as write a book and a song. So tell us about that a little bit.
Well, actually, I didn't write the song.
Who wrote the song?
Randy Boudreau.
Okay.
A guy from Cecilia, Louisiana. But wrote a lot of number one hits. And how that happened, you know, when we were racing, we used to always go karaoke, me and Mike Smith and Ronnie Ebanks. You know, Ronnie was a guy who liked to have a lot of fun.
Mike can dance.
And Mike can dance. And Ronnie can dance too. But Ronnie liked to sing, and we'd go karaoke, and that was our fun time. You know, we'd always find some place to go. If they didn't have karaoke, Ronnie would hire somebody to come and play karaoke at these bars, and we'd go to. So I got to sing a lot of karaoke, and they'd make me get up first, and, you know, and when I got hurt the first time, when I hurt my knee, my buddy Randy said, why don't you come down to Nashville and just spend a couple of days with me, you know, and we'll go over some of my records and songs that I wrote, and we'll just maybe go in the studio and see. So I went and I went through his catalog and started going through some songs. And we went in the studio and we ended up picking one that I kind of liked and just for him. And then he said, you know what? You don't sound too bad. And he said, Shane, this might be all right. And he said, you know what we can do? We're going to pay this guy for a year. We'll give him a little salary and whatever he writes, you know, we'll have royalties to it. And I said, okay. So one day he said, we got this song. He says, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Earnhardt. You know, I said, well, it's kind of strange, but, you know, it was an up-tempo song. And he, you know, he said, let's go in the studio and let's cut it. I said, okay. So we went and we cut it. And I'll never forget it. We was going to see one of his, this guy that he really, really liked. We was going to go watch him. He was in a country town about 40 minutes from Nashville. And Daryl Singletary, who's a great country singer, was with us. And he put the song in. He said, Daryl, listen to Shane's thing. And he played. He said, I like it. I like it. So I was a little embarrassed, you know. But we went and we was listening to this guy. And the lady came around with the drinks. You know, would y'all like something to drink? And about 10 o'clock, she came in and she said, did y'all hear the news? I said, no, we didn't. She said, Dale Earnhardt got killed today. And the hair stood up on my, and we looked at each other, and Daryl said, you know, you have that song, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Earnhardt. And I went, so we stayed that, you know, till about 12 or 1 o'clock, and we're on the way home. He said, put that song back in. It was Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Earnhardt. And he said, y'all got something here, man. Because, no, you know, after somebody gets killed, you know, there was a lot of people wrote a lot of songs after that. Mm-hmm. You know, the number eight and to try to make money off of it.
Yeah.
And we didn't try to, we didn't write it about the death of Earnhardt. We wrote about the life of Earnhardt, you know. And DreamWorks Records, which some friends of, had Toby Keith, Randy had let them listen to it. The next day they called me up and they signed me to a contract. And wow. It wasn't like I tried to do this. It was like, you know, and me and Randy got in the car, man, and we went to radio stations and played it. And it ended up number 56 on the charts. You know, and it was a gimmick song, kind of.
How many people can say that?
Not too many.
I mean, not too many, right? How many jockeys can say that?
Yeah, but the story, I don't think too many people know the story of how that happened.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that's maybe if, unfortunately, that he got killed, I don't think maybe it would have made it where it made it. But I was, you know, I was fortunate enough to play 6 or 7 shows. You know, I got on the bus and played the New Faces of Country Music and stuff. But I really was never a country music. I was a karaoke singer that made an album, but I did cut an album, had, you know, 9 songs on it, and you know, I'm a connoisseur of country music. I don't think they were great songs, but I did have an album out, and I was on Toby Keith's record label, so it was fun. You know, had a lot of fun, played with some good country music singers and enjoyed it. But again, I wasn't a country music singer. They hit the road, and you know, I just didn't have that kind of voice or the personality to make it, but I really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun.
The song was really good. Only about 2.5 minutes are left here before we have to wrap up this Jock Talk with Shane Seller. It's been an amazing visit. We could easily spend another hour or two. I feel like we've just kind of scratched the surface on some of the big stories, but I didn't even get a chance to ask you about going ice skating with your good friend Jerry LaSala in Chicago when he would take you to the ice rink. I didn't get a chance to ask you about that.
Yeah, Jerry would take. Yeah, Jerry could do anything. He'd beat you ping pong right handed or left handed, play pool. You know, Jerry could do anything. You know, and then he was a great hockey player.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, he'd take me ice skating. I couldn't stand up. You know, play baseball. He could play baseball. He hit right handed, left handed. Jerry could ride. He could do anything. Play pool. You know, anything that Jerry does with you. That he, if he wants to do it with you, he'll beat you at it. Other than that, he won't do it. But yeah, I couldn't ice skate.
What does the future hold here for Shane Sellers? What are you doing now?
I'm breaking babies on the farm in Versailles, raise a few babies, sell a few babies, break some, and have my little boy that I raised. He's 4 years old, a little boy that I adopted, which he's the love of my life.
Great kid.
He's a great kid, and it's hard on me, but you know. I don't really know how it really all unfolded, but he's with me now and just doing that, living life.
and living it very well. Shane Sellers has been an amazing ride for him and an amazing story here on Jock Talk. We hope you enjoyed it. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, you can go to our website, horseracingradio.net, listen to the podcast. You can also download it through iTunes, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. And believe me, you won't be disappointed. This show or any of the previous three, Christina, it's been amazing.
That's exactly right. The time just flies. It's amazing.
You said something a short time ago. We were in the commercial break. You said, you know, you get listening to the stories and you forget where you're going with your questions because the stories are so good.
I forget to ask what I'm supposed to ask.
That's so much fun. We're back with you next Tuesday, 6 o'clock Eastern, right here at horseracingradio.net. For our producer, Lee Delapina, Christina McManigal, and for Shane Sellers, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Jock Talk.